talking about Paul thorn in the flesh, you know, praying three times, Lord, move over.
That's all in that way you give this picture.
You're right.
That's it exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's
got a pretty picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he talks about 45 minutes. He doesn't want to get that over his head.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can understand more and more. Hello, Paul. Man, he said, I'm in a straight, pitch too literally. He's in a straight position. I'm leaving the Greek word on that, says he's perpendicular. Desire to be of the Lord needs to be far better than what needs to be done. And so, he just been right there, not the same.
And then, on another case, he said that he really didn't desire, not only really desired to be clothed upon that body in heaven. So, that's the thing.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, just bring you up to date this morning. Comes to things that you don't know. Do you know that you have the power of life and death in your own control? Amen. It's a good thing, Lord, you're so things were going too good. I wanted to get you right.
You're right. Dr. Bogart used to tell the Antioch church so many times about hurting when things were running smooth. He'd get to, now, wait a minute, folks. Now, things are running too smoothly. Okay, first thing you know, the devil's going to raise his head and he'll get something started. Well, that happened. And so, there you go. Okay, on page 99.
There you are.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Yeah.
We're noticing a little bit now the monarchical form of the mediatorial kingdom.
Monarchical form.
The theocracy. Oh, in other words, though, that I understand that if Khomeini gets elected what he wanted to, I'm going to make the vote now.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have a theocracy.
Yeah, yeah.
He's going to have a theocracy.
Yeah, he should be able to vote by the night.
Yeah.
But he'll have despotism.
Shouldn't he get all that authority?
Yeah. All right, so now we have noted the time of the judges. Now we're noting the time of the kings, when they had kings. Now we noted briefly the situation that developed as to why they had a king, but even when God had granted them that, we noted that God has something to say about who's going to be the king. All right. Noting number three now, the key to the monarchical problem. 1 Samuel 8 and 5 says, make us a king like all the nations. Some readers have been disturbed by the apparent problem connected with the inspired record of the change from judges to kings in the historical kingdom. Now the elders and the people had asked for a king. Samuel the prophet was greatly displeased with our attitude, speaking of it as wickedness, which ye have done in the sight of the Lord in asking you a king. 1 Samuel 12:17. And Jehovah himself had characterized their demand as something highly reprehensible, saying, they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. 1 Samuel 8:7. Moreover, he had warned the nation of the troubles which would come upon them because of the king they wanted. 1 Samuel 8:10-18. Yet when the people refused to heed his warning, God said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice and make them a king. 1 Samuel 8:22. Furthermore, the establishment of kings was quite evidently within the plan of God for the nation of Israel, Genesis 17:6, Deuteronomy 17. Now the problem posed is simply this. If the request for a king was right, why was it called wickedness? On the other hand, if the request was wicked, why did God grant it? The answer to this question is twofold. First, God did not give to the people of Israel exactly what they asked. For one thing, they were not given the right to set up a king of their own choosing, as in the case of other nations. And this brings us in the second place to the real key to the problem, which is found in the terms of the original request for a king. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations, 1 Samuel 8:5. The repugnant thing about this demand lies in the qualifying clause, like all the nations. As a matter of fact, the setting up a king like all the nations was wholly unnecessary from the divine standpoint. The rule of God up until this time had been mediated through leaders, judges, and prophets. Even David the king, after God's own heart,
that thus I served as head of the state without having all the worldly trappings and material splendors of an Oriental court. Up to this time, Israel had had a very simple and unique government, uncomplicated in organization and function. Problems were dealt with as they arose, and when the king, like all the nations, Israel would be exchanging the simple theocratic form of government based on moral principles and dedicated to the general welfare for something which could become an unwieldy and monstrous governmental structure dedicated mainly to its own perpetuation. Such an arrangement was not only unnecessary, but could only add to the burdens of the people and increase the restrictions upon their personal liberties. Therefore, although God assented in part, notice that in part, to the nation's request, he rebuked them for making it, and at the same time solemnly warned them of the perils they were getting into. 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 to 18. Now the words of Keel are very much to the point here. This comes from Keel and Leach, volume 3, page 384, footnote. The appointment of a king is not commanded like the institution of judges, Deuteronomy 16, 18. Because Israel could exist under the government of Jehovah even without an earthly king, it is simply permitted, in case the need should rise, for a regal or kingly government. Now then, the period of the monarchical glory. 2 Chronicles 9:22. King Solomon passed all the kings of earth in riches and wisdom. The mediatory kingdom of Old Testament history reached the pinnacle of its power and glory under its first three kings, each of whom held his throne by the decree and direct appointment of Jehovah. The entire monarchical career of Saul is summarized by the prophet Samuel in two brief statements. First, the Lord anointed thee king over Israel. And second, the Lord hath rejected thee from being king over Israel. 1 Samuel 15, 17, verses 17 and 26. And incidentally, I believe Daniel brings out something that even today, ruler gets to be a certain ruler, God allows such, and he may take him down and out. It just in the old times, he takes him out. And I have an idea that God's going to take care of Comini over yonder, without Miss Lillian not having $1 million to hire somebody to go to assassinate him. You take care of him. After the failure and rejection of Saul, it is Jehovah again who exercises his right of sovereign choice in the case of David. 1 Samuel 16, verses 1 and 13. And as his life on earth drew to its close, speaking as a prophet to whom the word of God, the Lord had come, David thus indicates the divine choice of succession. Of all my sons, for them whom the Lord hath given me many sons, he hath chosen Solomon, my son, to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. 1 Chronicles 25. It is not without significance that Solomon, last of the kings directly chosen of God, is also the last king of the United Kingdom of Israel. Because we notice that after Solomon, there was
his son, and then an army officer. The result was this kingdom split. From Saul to Solomon, there was an almost incredible expansion and transformation of the nation of Israel. In the work of Brian, in one brief generation, she had been transferred from a loose, disjointed tribal league fighting for its life into a united, self-conscious nation of some importance in the world. Most of the land, though all as promised, was now in Israelite hands, a fact she never forgot. Literature and culture flourished as never before. There was unexpected material prosperity. It was a proud thing to be an Israelite in the 10th century B.C. All right, you notice down here two footnotes we need to take time to look at. The tremendous military achievements of David cleared the way for the more peaceful work of Solomon. The Philistines, perennial and powerful foes of Israel, were decisively defeated and brought into subjection. 2 Samuel 5, verses 17 to 25, and chapter 8, verse 1. The city of Jerusalem was captured and made the new capital of the nation. 2 Samuel 5, 6 to 10. The conquest of the Philistine cities was completed. Across the Jordan, the troublesome kingdom of Moab, Ammon, and Edom were reduced to tributaries. Other kings, watching with concern the progress of this new power, came prudently to seek peace. 2 Samuel 8, verse 2 to 15. Occupying a high strategic geographical location in the ancient world, the kingdom of Israel had swiftly become a compact political factor, which could not be ignored by any of the surrounding nations. With military security now assured, Solomon proceeded to expand the scope and activities of his kingdom. Certain strategic points were strongly fortified, the cost being defrayed by means of special levies. 1 Kings 9, 15 to 19. The nation's military forces were increased and a navy established. 1 Kings 9, 22 and 26. Alliances with foreign nations were made, sometimes a fearful seal by diplomatic marriages. 1 Kings 9, 16 and 11 and 1. A special alliance with the king of Tyre brought skillful artisans into the land, 1 Kings 5, 1, 18, and also led to a wide expansion of foreign trade, 1 Kings 9, 26, 28, chapter 10, verse 22. Recent archaeological discoveries of great and ingeniously constructed copper smelters at Ezion-Geber, although not specifically mentioned in the Bible, account for the profusion of this metal and its alloys, 1 Kings 7, 47. The wealth of the nation increased beyond comprehension. The king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stone, 1 Kings 10:27. Gold flowed into the kingdom in great quantity, 1 Kings 9:27-28, and chapter 10, verses 2 and 14. The inspired record of these glories of the historical kingdom is couched in the language of superlatives. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom which God had put in his heart. 1 Kings 10, verses 23 and 24. Giving all due consideration to the purely natural factors, No one can successfully explain this glorious era apart from the providential and also supernatural workings of God, as some modern critics have sought to do. The testimony of the contemporary Queen of Sheba reveals a keener discernment. The hand was not told me. Blessed be the Lord thy God, which delighteth in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel, and therefore made he thee king to do judgment and justice. 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 7 to 9. In concluding on this point, it must be noted that under Solomon, we have only a continuation of the same divine kingdom which had been established historically at Sinai with Moses as the mediatorial ruler. There was no change in its original constitution and law. This is clearly affirmed in David's final charge to his son Solomon. I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways, keep his statutes and his commandments, and his judgments and his testimony, as it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest and whithersoever thou turnest thyself. 1 Kings 2, verses 2 and 3, italics added. The kingdom under Solomon must continue to operate in conformity with the original constitution and laws as laid down in the Mosaic Code. Furthermore, the identification of Solomon's kingdom as God's own kingdom was confirmed in no uncertain fashion when, at the dedication of Solomon's temple, the fire came down from heaven and was with Saul. All right, so now we've noted two phases in which this move, after its founding at Sinai, under Judges, and then under the era of the king.
You know, Brother Farrar, I see this a little bit differently than the writer does in some ways.
Yeah, I follow your argument there. Now, just like today, we get heartsick as we watch the apostles. Well, God knew it was coming. Well, I get a little aggravated sometimes that simply when some people begin to get up in the world a little bit financially or known little prestige and a little super education or something like that, don't you say? Usually it will go to their heads. And whenever that thing happens, you will usually find that they aren't the ones who will lead in some frozen times. But God permits it, though I don't think he, well, he didn't plan it that way.
He allows it.
He allows it.
Will, but still, his unpreventable progress is so nearly blind and woven in there that he planned to use them in spite of
it. Yeah, that's right. Well, you take, for instance, now, the statement that Paul made in 1 Corinthians. The Lord has called many wise and so on, as the world counts them wise. And this, that, and other, into the ministry. But I say, he's chosen more or less what the world calls the foolish things that will confound the wise worldly people. And so, they have. Now we come to note the decline of the Mediatorial Kingdom in the Old Testament history. Reached its glory under Solomon, now in the height of its glory, rather. And even though during David and Solomon's time, already present were the seeds of political catastrophe. James Orr says, from the footnote Kingdom of God Dictionary of the Bible by James Hastings, it is a marvelous fact that it was not because Israel was succeeding in fulfilling its mission, but because it was faith in it that the spirit of prophecy wrought so powerfully. Let's reread that again. It is a marvelous fact that it was not because Israel was succeeding in fulfilling its mission, but because it was failing in it that the spirit of prophecy wrought so powerfully. Now, without attempting to subtract from David and Solomon any of thy excellences, which were many, it is a striking commentary on the quality of sinful men that in the very period of the historical kingdom's greatest success, there were already present the seeds of political catastrophe. Thus, if we are wise, we shall not misunderstand that with reference to salvation, whether spiritual or political, with men this is impossible, Matthew 19:26. In such matters there are always things to be done which only God can do. All right? We note first the personal failure of Solomon. 2 Samuel 7:14, if he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men. Here it must be recorded to the shame of Solomon, this favored king of Israel, that at last he had settled down in open violation of the first three divine rules which had been given by Jehovah to govern the conduct of kings under the constitution of the kingdom. Compare Deuteronomy 17:14-17. First, he multiplied military forces of a kind specifically forbidden in the law of God, gathering together chariots and horsemen and horses brought out of Egypt, 1 Kings 10:26-28. Second, Solomon loved many foreign women, and he had 700 wives, princes, and 300 concubines, 1 Kings 11:1-3-4, American Standard Version. Third, he piled up silver and gold until the silver became common as stone in Jerusalem, and even the vessels of his own house of Lebanon were ordered made of pure gold, 1 Kings 10:21-27. And so, along with all this great worldly power and wealth, there came moral deterioration and finally religious apostasy. His wives turned away his heart as other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father, 1 Kings 11:4. Now, we might see a parallel with that today, brethren. A church, as long as she sees her need, recognizes her need, and is up on her knees, so to speak, that church is powerful. But whenever that church becomes rich and increased with goods, that's like the Laodicean. Oh, we don't have need of anything. But what do we find?
Well, the Lord makes it clear that they're blind, they're naked, in an awful condition. And that is true. And let me know something else here now. Too many times these preachers, whenever they're going pretty tough, well, we used to be down pretty low. But when we kind of get our way figured out according to our wisdom and get things going our way, may be the worst thing in the world. And I don't care if it's a church, if it's a school, or whatever it is, brethren. Whenever they think we put a love like that, all we have to do is just tell the people what we want and all what here in the night. You better watch that. You better watch that. First thing you know, you'll see a bunch of men forming themselves into kind of a committee of one. And they work and they love the power and the prestige and so on that they get along with that. Whereas down low. Now, there ought to be something that can listen for. And that's true with us in our own life. In every facet of life, as long as we will stay humble and use what the Lord has blessed us with for His honor and glory, then we can be blessed with it. But we've got to watch it, because remember, all right, but this was not all. Economic problems arose. Building projects, military fortifications, ship construction, foreign trade, all these required the labor of men. One source of manpower was found, of course, in the non-Israelites, still living in the land and who were pressed into continual bond service, 1 Kings 9:15-21. Military service was apparently restricted to Israelites, 1 Kings 9:22-23, which was doubtless the intent of David in numbering the people, 2 Samuel 24:1-9. And Solomon may have used this original census for this purpose. But now, in addition to this type of service, Solomon proceeded to raise a levy out of all Israel, amounting to 30,000 men who were forced to labor in Lebanon 1 month out of every 3, 1 Kings 5:13-14. This was a revival of the Hebrew corvée system, remembered by the nation as an intolerable entrance experience, rather, in the land of Egypt. It had been estimated that 30,000 men under forced labor in Israel, compared in terms of the present population of the United States, would equal no less than 5 million men. Furthermore, to maintain this far-flung government and the luxury of his own court and household, Solomon required more and more wealth. His father David had been able to enrich the national treasure by means of the spoil taken in his unbroken succession of military victory, 2 Samuel 8:1-11. But the era of peace under Solomon made it essential to find internal sources of income. This meant taxation, which free men from time immemorial have hated and resisted. That was Luke
news the other day after the, let's see, what's this other proposition passed that's supposed to cut income tax 50%? And you know, after Proposition 13 passed, the governor of the state jumped on the bandwagon and thought he was the one who got it up and got it passed and everything. But the other day I noticed his dad had organized something to fight this income tax business with. The point simple is this. The political forces love the money, but they got and handle them and don't have to give too much an account for. The king's plan was thoroughly organized under 12 chief officers who knew to what to see that the court of Solomon was provided for month by month for the king's court. Verses 6 to 19. At the end of 20 years of building, more money had to be raised. And in some kind of a deal made with King Hiram of Tyre, Solomon must have either given away or mortgaged 20 cities in the land of Galilee. 1 Kings 9 and 14. One wonders just how such a business deal appeared in the eyes of the tribe which owned the territory, thus handed over cavalry to an outsider who was a Canaanite. Grateful as England might feel toward our own country for aid in two world wars, it takes no special imagination to picture what would happen to the current English government if its prime minister would hand over to us 20 cities of the British Isles, even if these cities were not much to look at as Ireland seemed to have regarded Solomon's gift. With all this constant drain on the economic resources and manpower of Israel, which must have stirred up irritation and discontent, it is little wonder that when Solomon's son came to the throne, the first word of the people was, "Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee." 1 Kings 12:4. But the reply of Rehoboam was a contemptuous no, an ominous harbinger of worse things yet to come. Fort C. Austin has well said, "A king never came to a mighty throne with greater promise than Solomon. Yet Solomon faith, ascending to the throne, girded by omnipotence itself, he ended his career shorn of his strength, bereft of his glory, with his heart turned away from Jehovah and the anger of God kindled against him." All right, now then we notice the rupture of the nation, or the division. 2 Kings 17:18, "There was none left but the tribe of Judah only." Even before the death of Solomon, the sickness of the state was clearly evident. The tribes had always been jealous of their independence and rights. And both David and his son had worked for a genuine political unification of the nation. The undertaking of the magnificent temple at Jerusalem had given definite impetus to a greater centralization of the national worship of Jehovah. Actually, of course, only the true religion of Israel could forge a bond capable of holding the tribes together. And the apostasy of Solomon severed this bond. 1 Kings 11:1-10. Adversaries began to stir up trouble in various places. verse 14, 23, verses 26 through 28. The final result was the succession of 10 tribes under the leadership of Jeroboam, whose outstanding ability had already been recognized by Solomon, 1 Kings 11, verses 24 to 43. Since it had been authorized directly by Jehovah through the prophet Ahijah, the succession must be regarded as a divine judgment upon the chosen nation and its mediatorial king, for both had grievously sinned. Viewed from the standpoint of Solomon, the immediate successor, Rehoboam, the loss of the 10 tribes was a perfectly senseless thing. At the death of Solomon, we are told all Israel were come to Shechem to make Rehoboam king. Even his rival Jeroboam was among them, 1 Kings 12, 1 to 3. They offered to serve the heir of Solomon if he would only like David's words, which had been imposed by his father. But Rehoboam, impatient with the sage advice of these older counselors, chose to follow the reckless course suggested by his playboy associates to the very modern and reasonable plea of his people, the king replied roughly, "My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whip, but I will chastise you with scorpion." 1 Kings 12, 4-14. The hostile reaction of the people was thus made inevitable. "What portion have we in David?" they cried. "To your tents, O Israel." More than tribes turned to Jeroboam, and there was none that followed down from David, but the tribe of Judah only, 1 Kings 12, 16 to 20. The tribe of Benjamin was formed and divided in its allegiance, for we read in the next verse, that is 21, that when Jeroboam assembled his military expedition to force a reunion of the tribe of Benjamin was represented in the army. Okay.
You know, Brother Farr, looking at this, and the tax system and everything back then, when we get right down to it, we're worse off than we're under Solomon, right?
Yeah.
Because, see, they work 1 hour every 3 days for the government.
Mm-hmm.
1 out of 2 days for the government now.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Every day you work one for the government, one for yourself, one for the government, one for yourself. Or 3/4 for the community, 1/4 for the government, whatever that is. Sometimes it's
better. Well, I could well remember, brethren, back, it was just a little before my remembrance. But throughout part of the country, we didn't have a county or the parish road system or anything. What did the people do? They got out themselves with their shovels, their axes, and their saws, and cleared out, prepared the roads, and so on. And I have known some winter time the old road would get pretty rough. Bunch of them get together and go out and cut saplings, we call them small holes, and then waylay sections of that road so it can be passable and things like that. People worked together. They were happier in doing that than our brother when you began to force them after doing it. But so many times, and I think that we're going to get some things done a little easier, and we're going to shift the burden from ourselves a little bit. We just get the work end of the day. And that's the way.